This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, so sitting in front of me now is Gwen Gwenya. We've had her on as a guest before. She's a very accomplished woman with plenty of interesting things going on in her own life, but she also writes a regular blog, sometimes a column. She's written in various publications. She's one of those people who sometimes takes a contrarian approach to things, which doesn't always get her lots of friends. But I just love independent thinkers. And Gwen is nothing if not that. So I think that's probably the highest compliment I can pay her before we start talking to her this morning. It's just after 7 o'clock. Usually at this time we have Justice Malana in with the Burning Platform. He couldn't make it today. So I thought we'd get Gwen in and we'd do a sort of surrogate Burning Platform. And I'd ask her about her opinion on a bunch of things that are going on in the country. You know, it's sometimes good to have people who are smarter than you come in and tell you about what they think of what's going on. So how are you, Gwen?
I'm great. Thanks. And yourself, Gary?
Good. You looked very nervous when you sat down. I was worried that maybe we didn't make you feel, you know, last time we didn't make you feel comfortable enough or something.
No, not at all. Maybe I just haven't had my morning cup of coffee.
Well, we can help you with that. Flex.
Flex.
Must our guests die of dehydration?
Get to it, Flex.
Please.
How do you take your coffee?
How do you have your coffee? Yeah. Flex, come in here and kneel.
Black and no sugar.
Black and no sugar, Flex. Thank you.
There we go.
I mean, they couldn't have asked for a simpler thing. We could do that, right, Mubs?
That we just did.
Oh. Wow. Well, we sent our servant Flex.
Well, I mean, you know.
Hierarchy and all
right.
That.
So, listen, Gwen, a couple of things that I think we need to talk about this morning. You obviously pay very close attention to the news just because it interests you. You like
yes.
to know about the context of your environment and what's going on politically, socially, economically. So I sent a bunch of things to Michael yesterday to forward to you so we could have your opinion on them. Shall we start with Fees Must Fall? It wasn't so long ago that you were a student. In fact, you were on the SRC.
Yes.
I recall you were, you weren't just on the SRC. Tell us about how involved you actually were.
Well, I joined the Democratic Alliance Students Organization quite in the early days. And so one of the first sort of opposition SRC, you know, student bodies to be elected at GCT. I spent the first year at the SRC as the vice president. And
not an underachiever at all.
And then I was then became the president of the SRC 2 years later.
At UCT.
At GCT, yes.
All right. So as president of the SRC, I mean, you were in a position then to have regular interaction with management, with students, with the workers on campus, with outside bodies, whether it was, you know, parents or whether it was other institutions, whatever it might have been. So you were in a unique position to be able to take in everything going on around you and try to figure out what was best for the students who you represented. How has that changed since you left as the president of the SRC and where we are now, where we have tertiary education institutions on the brink of either some very, very serious financial problems at the very least, or at the more dangerous end, a total collapse in some cases where, you know, lectures have been abandoned and where we aren't going to graduate this year and some people will have to take on another year and they're going to be even more costs. All of this is very, very real and it's certainly hitting home. How has this all changed in your experience over the last few years?
Well, I mean, the problems are very much still the same when I was there. I've always, even when I was in the SRC, there used to be former SRC members who had come back to the university and say universities are kind of a frozen time capsule. You leave and 10 years later when you come back, SRC, what they called their interrogation sessions, are still questioning the same things. So in a great sense, things don't seem to change. But I think what has changed is the momentum and the ability to galvanize national support around issues which certainly wasn't present when I was there. And I think that's not so much just the African scenario. I think there's a lot of global confluence of events as far as that's concerned as well. If we just look globally at what has happened in terms of student uprising, I think it's not a uniquely South African scenario. But what I do feel is South Africa needs to perhaps get correct is a prioritization of what the real issues are in the higher education space. So, of course, right now the demand of students is for, obviously free education. This is not a new call. SASCO is making the same demands back then. But I think what has made this particular student protests or series of student protests different is the increasing external and interference in what are student issues. And it's not to say the public should not be involved, but I do believe that it doesn't always represent the majority of student opinion.
Who are these outside influences? Are they political parties?
Yes, I mean, political parties, I mean, I would be the first to admit that I ran on a political platform as well when I was a member of the SRC. But whether people choose to believe it or not, we're far more independent. We basically decide our own mandates, our own agendas. And there was not as much, you know, presence of political leaders or political direction on campus activities. I wouldn't be the only commentator who said that at least what we're seeing on student campuses now is people who are leading these protests who don't even seem to be registered students of the various institutions, which is obviously quite problematic. And especially Manuele, the guy who's been quite at the forefront, well, he's known as the poo thrower officially. Right. He was at GCT when I was there. And even when I was there, he was older than I was. So I don't even know.
How long is this guy going to be at varsity is what we're all
forever,
asking.
It seems. I'm not even sure, according to the university rules, how he has managed to remain at university for this long.
My question is, what do these external factors or these outside elements, what do they have to gain from injecting themselves into these movements and then causing them to become as disruptive as they have?
Well, I believe political parties can sometimes face lethargy in terms of active supporters and active mobilization. So when you have a mobilized or galvanized force already, of course you want to, you know, pick up that momentum and be at the forefront of that movement. And certainly student issues are the number one issue that have been on people's, well, at least in terms of what people talk about around the dinner table, what the media reports on. So just from a strategic, even communications point of view, it's a no-brainer that any politician might want to be seen as owning, you know, that particular issue.
Do they basically just look for relevance? The political parties. That's what they're after here.
Yes, I mean, it's the famous adage by Mahatma Gandhi who said, I mean, the students are already leading this, but the politicians that then say, well, look, there go my people, let me go lead them. So, you know, so I don't necessarily think the student politic needs to be led necessarily, but there's no shortage of politicians
I think one of the reasons people liked Fees Must Fall last year and how that's changed. Last year when it came about that all these students had decided they'd had enough and they decided to take up a real active protest and they marched to the union buildings and everyone was in favor, is because it wasn't politically party motivated. It was more of a groundswell.
Well, I'm a bit skeptical about that, Gary. I think always been politically motivated. I think people like to establish these romantic ideals of a united, independent sort of agenda, but nobody's really independent. What does that even mean to be politically independent? That you have no political views, no political allegiances?
We may have found someone more cynical than me about this. All right. Let's turn our attention to some other things that should worry us. The national broadcaster, he's coming here later today, the former CEO, now the what do they call him? The chief communications or corporate affairs.
I think it's corporate affairs, stakeholding, buttering up.
Right.
I think that's the official title.
Hladi Motsoeneng, he will be a guest this afternoon on Touch's show. But I heard a couple of interviews with this guy, Hladi, and he's got a lot of people very concerned about the state of that institution, but also about the level of catered deployment which has happened and how he is almost the poster boy for the worst kind of catered deployment, because there's absolutely no indication that there's merit in his in his position that he's been given now or before.
Well, I mean, that position has been corroborated by the public protector, by the courts. I think there's absolutely no doubt in many people's minds that he's absolutely unfit to be in that particular position. And there's every indication, at least even from SABC staff, that he enjoys quite a close position to both the communications minister, Faith Mutambi, as well as obviously number one himself. So I think the political interference or the, you know, deployment of cadres can't be doubted. But what's problematic about the ANC is their capacity to confuse the general populace by, you know, wearing different hats on different occasions. So the same ANC that has deployed this cadre into central government and indeed has prevented the, you know, the broadcasting of protests to safeguard the ANC's interests, has now its own chief whip calling for an inquiry or et cetera into
Jackson
and Tembo. And,
exactly. And we hear from Zizi Kodwa that they think that it's time that the SABC takes stock, so the state takes stock of itself and starts to end this kind of madness.
But it can't be trusted, because the ANC, as I said, it wears different hats. It wants, at the same time, the sort of vanguard of media freedom or of freedom of speech, and at the same time, the violator of it. So which one is it? And Jackson Mthembu, a long time ago, even since last year, I think it was at the ANC's NGC, where he even then was highly critical of what was going on in the SABC. A year later, nothing has changed. So I think any critique that comes from him should really be taken with a pinch of salt as to how far-reaching those interventions could potentially be.
Now, I had this discussion with Julius Malema when he was in here, and I thought it would be a good idea to talk to you about this too. When the opposition party complain about President Zuma, aren't they actually shooting themselves in the foot? Doesn't it suit them to have him stay in office as long as possible? For every day that Jacob Zuma is the president of the ANC, he's sending votes to the opposition parties, the EFF and the DA.
Well, yes, but if we like to believe that there's at least an ounce of benevolence in the opposition parties, then I suppose they should be working to get rid of him as soon as possible. But, of course, from a strategic point of view, I agree. At least the local government elections bear out that much of the ANC's success seemed to be tied to public perception of Jacob Zuma. And certainly the longer you can keep the idiot in office, the greater the opposition's prospects will be.
You've worked
in the national election, that is.
Absolutely. I don't think anyone would disagree with you, but it there is this interesting balance that it could be very self-serving for them to keep him in as long as possible.
Yes.
It wouldn't be good for the country.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Now, what about the fact that you've worked in companies in the financial sector and you understand, I suppose, a little better than someone like me, how the economy and the currency and the stock exchange and all of these things interact with each other from a point of view of how they fit into politics. The Minister of Finance, this is a strategic position in government. It's a very important position in government. There's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing at the moment about what exactly is going on with the Minister of Finance. We had that horrible, excruciating incident in December when Nhlanhla Nene was replaced overnight by Des Van Rooyen. Des Van Rooyen lasted for the weekend, and then suddenly Pravin Gordhan was back in. What kind of an office is the Office of the Minister of Finance? How important is it for financial institutions, for financial businesses in that sector, and for ordinary South Africans to engage and interact with that office?
The office is incredibly important. I mean, not just in South African terms, but it's a central position in most government ministries across the world. People do look to it, obviously, as a barometer of the independence of the fiscus of the government and how much you can have somebody who is free from government interference in terms of managing or ensuring fiscal prudence, which, especially with a continuing looming of credit downgrade, is incredibly important in South Africa. But I think what's even more important that perhaps is not often touched upon is how suddenly now South Africa's fortunes seem to be tied to one man. The ANC obviously doesn't like it, neither do I, quite frankly. I don't think it's a good thing for South Africa to have this, what I call the Gordhan Index, where the health or security of one man is a reflection of the security of the rest of the country. But if Gordhan has become a martyr, it's entirely the ANC's doing, whereas they'd have us believe that, well, Des Van Rooyen, when he chooses now to wear his hat as the Treasurer General of the Umkhonto we Sizwe, Veterans Association, has denounced or criticized Gordhan for, putting himself out there as a Jesus of note, as he says. And similarly, the Secretary General, what's his name, Thandi Moroka, I think, of the ANC Youth League, has also criticized him for garnering sympathy with media. But they've built him up as a martyr, and there's absolutely no doubt that he now occupies that status. Gordhan is the personification of the South African economy and the middle-class household purse, I feel. I mean, of course, the poor are also affected by Gordhan's actions, but I think that their their proximity to the consequences are often a lot more indirect. So a hit on Gordon tends to hit the markets first, reflected in the currency and bond markets usually. Mm-hmm. But eventually hit the markets hard enough and your fundamentals begin to falter. Companies, especially those who have operations domestically based, begin to report lower earnings. There's the corporate appetite for risk in South Africa is fundamentally dampened and investment contracts. And we ultimately see this in the persistently high unemployment rates that South Africa continues to witness. But the fact that Pravin Gordhan is the sole credible barometer of investor confidence in South Africa is problematic, but it's also been set up by a government that otherwise lacks credibility. So the position of finance minister is important globally. But the fact Gordon the Savior is not a media construct. It was part of actually his initial job mandate. He specifically came in, ironically, to save the country from Des van Rooyen. So his very almost mandate is as a savior. That's the pretext or the circumstance in which he assumed office. So he's almost like this voodoo doll, literally, where pricking a needle into Gordon is like, you know, the entire country vicariously winces, you know, every time he's affected or there's an investigation against him.
Yeah, and we've made this. The ANC's made this and the people of this country have made this because we put all our hopes and dreams into this basket.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so let's go full circle back to fees must fall, because a lot of people tell me, well, the solution really to any problem like this where there isn't enough money for poor people to get ahead is to just tax everybody who does have money at 90%. Why would that not work?
Well,
this is largely opinion. I mean, there are going to be people who disagree, but
exactly.
What's your point of view?
And I was about to say that people don't like vague answers, but there's a lot of grey in this. And I say this as somebody who studied economics, is that there's no clear empirical evidence as to what the effect on taxation is. In fact, in the United States, I couldn't find any local examples, but there was a Stanford study that actually showed, because obviously the states are allowed to set their own taxation rates. So mm-hmm. one would think that millionaires across the United States are moving from states with lower taxation rates from the high tax states. But there's no evidence to really support that. But what there is an indicator of is that people do move based on more fundamental indicators about and expectations of that state or country's sort of future outlook or economic outlook. So people will move if there's a lack of jobs. People will move if the environment is not conducive to starting new businesses.
And obviously the people
and if the quality of life is not good.
And the people who will make that move first are the ones you can afford to.
Exactly. So I have no doubt that the wealthy in South Africa, there is an export. I think it was Magnus Haystack who recently this week, I think in a quite a widely shared article, who said that South Africa's greatest exports are the wealthy. But they're not just moving because of taxes, because if you had a Scandinavian model where you were highly taxed, but actually the state actually provided decent healthcare, the state was actually good at, you know, providing security. And so essentially in South Africa now, the wealthy pay twice for everything. They pay taxes, but they actually still provide a lot of government services on their own. They still have private healthcare and they have private security, etc. So I think it's not so much that they will leave just as a result of tax, but they do leave when those taxes are not deployed in an appropriate manner. And just, I mean, one last thing on taxation is that the focus is in the wrong place, I believe. The problem fundamentally with South Africa, as far as taxation is concerned, is that our tax base is just not large enough. So you have around 5% paying over 50% of South Africa's personal income tax, and that's it's highly disproportionate.
5% to 50%.
Exactly. You have about 589,000, according to a 2013 tax statistics report compiled by SARS, the National Treasury, in 2013, indicating that you have about 589,000 people paying over 53% of personal income tax in South Africa.
Wow.
And that's a very, very small pool of people, which if the tax flight, or not, I wouldn't call it a tax flight, but if their flight because of government services or their taxes that are not accurately or appropriately used continues, then that poses a serious challenge. And there's this assumption by the left that the rich are are like trees, this rooted cohort of people who cannot move, and that all you need to simply do to fix the country's problem is tax the rich more, as though they're available for an unlimited amount of abuse, which is not true.
Well, there's a lot to think about there. Just in one last point, I see a lot of reports going out all over the place, left, right, and center at the moment, asking, where is the president? We haven't heard a peep out of him for the longest time. Does anyone know where he is, Mubs? Have you been? I know he went to China for a while, and then he appeared in Parliament briefly. But where's he been?
Let me try and track his latest movements.
All these fees must fall protests, not a peep out of him. He sent poor Blade to the slaughter to do it. And I very hesitantly say poor Blade because he kind of deserves this harvest that he's reaping now.
If I put a political hat on, if I was somebody's chief of staff, I'd say they're doing a bloody good job. The last thing you want to do is the leader taking all the heat. So whoever's managing that, you know, PR nightmare has done an excellent job, because that's exactly, of course, what you want. You want everyone else fielding all the antagonistic questions. You want everyone else taking the flack for all of your issues. So whoever's his chief of staff is doing an excellent job as far as I'm concerned. But it is problematic for South Africa.
He's probably just chilling in Nkandla.
Well, the latest thing that he ticked off on his agenda was he spoke at the Black Business Council's gala dinner on Tuesday. Oh. So that's the last of his duties.
The Black Business Council, is this Jimmy Manye's bunch? Because Jimmy Manye
has
been
Black Professionals. Oh, BMF,
well,
Black
who can remember?
Yes.
What did you say? Black what?
Management Forum.
Oh, I thought you said something else. I heard something else that rhymes with Mother Trucker. No, you wouldn't have said anything like that.
No.
Okay, well, thank you, Gwen. It's nice to hear from you, and it's good to have your insights into these things. Let's see how much we can figure out in the next couple of days. Obviously, we're going to be watching Pravin Gordhan carefully. What else are you watching that we need to be aware of? What do you think are the main indicators of our health, economically and politically?
Well, I think we've discussed the right things, but if I can almost take this conversation on a rather unexpected detour,
yeah.
There is an issue that I think has not received enough airtime and intend to abuse the platform.
Go on.
The issue of essentially there's a Labour Laws Amendment Bill that's been in front of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee and basically discussing the allocation of parental leave in South Africa and the fact that fathers don't get enough leave. So
yeah,
I think
they get 3 days or something?
It's outrageous.
Their child is born.
Yes. So it can't even officially be called a paternity leave scheme, since it's actually they take it under your ordinary family obligations, which everyone is in fact entitled to.
So you're on the side of having this amendment that fathers should get some parental time off when their kids are born.
Well, I think the details need to be etched out in terms of feasibility, but I see no reason, and maybe this is where many women would rail against what I have to say, but to actually share the maternity leave with the men. So many women, in fact, there's evidence to show, do not take up the full 4 months that they are statutorily allocated.
Entitled to, yeah.
Many will just take the 6 weeks to actually recuperate health-wise and maybe another month, but there's evidence show that allocation could be better split between the parents if they were able to do so. But over and above the government's regulations, many companies, in fact, provide extended leave provisions that go far and beyond what the government obliges them to do. So you have companies like Pick and Pay, where I think the last time I reviewed it, gave about 11 months.
Sure.
But actually, Pick and Pay is one of the leaders in that department, because they offer that to both men and women. But there's definitely a conversation to be had there about men's role in terms of taking care of their families, women's role in the workplace, if we're to take that seriously, and the sharing of childcare, because I think childcare takes up a huge proportion of what many women do.
I have another question that could result in problematic responses.
Let's go.
Would fathers want more time off of work to tend to their responsibilities as fathers at home?
So I've just advocated for regulation, but now this is where I put more of my more liberal side of me, is to say that actually what the regulation is aiming to do is to provide an accommodating space for families, though, to make their own choices. So I don't actually care if fathers use this. The point is they're able to do so, and then it's, well, now the ball is in your court. But as it stands, should families want to allocate their childcare arrangements differently, they're not currently able to do so. Mm. So I'm not concerned with who actually uses this and how they do it. I think people need to decide for themselves.
The attitude just needs to be, we don't punish you for having children.
Exactly.
Because okay. I think a lot of mothers would appreciate fathers getting more time off of work to help them at home, because they basically operate like zombies in those beginning uh-huh. months. It's hard, at least from what I've seen and what I've been told.
All right. Let's. By the way, Rusty says, no. This woman you have on now is too intelligent. Too many four-syllable words so early in the morning. You're overwhelming my low-functioning brain. Good job, he says. So well done, Gwen. There we go. You got some fans already. Thank you very much for coming to see us this morning. The Burning Platform, a different kind of Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's this morning. And Gwen and Gwenya standing in for Justice Malala, who will be back next week.
This is CliffCentral.com.